I'm Annika Ord from the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and this is Alaska Voices, a place where community members, friends, and scientists can share stories and place-based knowledge in order to build a better tomorrow for Alaskans and the world.
Originally, I grew up in Gakona, Alaska.
Tyonek.
Egypt.
Idaho.
Rampart.
St. Lawrence Island.
St. Paul.
And I'm here with my student.
My science buddy.
My teacher. My
homie. I'm his daughter.
My name is Gloria Wolf. I'm from Yakutat. I'm 40. My husband is related to these guys. So excited to see where this conversation goes. Vinachish.
Nankudangas, Eric Hamer. I am 33 years old, currently in Sitka, from Kasan. Spent some time in Icy Bay outside of Yakutat. I am also related to these guys, either through blood or marriage, and through the good work of Indigenous peoples.
Oh.
Young warrior.
My name's George Nix. I'm 34 years old. I'm currently also in Sitka, living in Kasan. Relationship with these guys is, like everyone said, cousins.
Why do you guys do the work that you guys do?
May I go first?
Yeah.
I grew up down in Washington, and being Alaskan native, I was a spectator. And that was all I could be down south, was spectator. And didn't really get to be involved in actually being in the culture, and I felt like an outsider. My first trip to Alaska, I visited Cake. They like to say Cake America. Within the first 15 minutes of arriving in that village, I felt like I was almost home. I was able to dive fully into the food security, and what that was for Kasan was being able to provide foods for elders and being able to take the youth and educate them on how to not only get it, but get it respectfully. Coming up here, you learn from your elders and from the people that have been here longer than you. The best way to get better at anything is asking questions and seeking those knowledge bearers. One of the most, I guess, inspirational things that I've heard was that every time an elder passes away, it's the equivalent to a library burning down.
Mm. Wow.
And one of the most important things that we can do, especially with our elders and our knowledge bearers, is dig for that information. Ask them, because they're wanting to pass it along. And I've noticed that a lot of the ways that I've learned to practice and harvest and do it respectfully and culturally is through listening and asking questions. So now that I have the ability to do that with a tribal entity behind me to support me and carry forth the missions that Kasan is bringing, it's an honor to be a part of that. And I'm passionate about bringing food and protecting our food and showing them how to do it respectfully.
So this job's kind of helped you to reconnect through reaching out and learning more. I know whenever I'm doing dry fish or any kind of fish or filleting or anything with some new people, I'm learning a new way, you know, and I always tell my sons that too. If somebody asks you, you know how to fillet fish, you don't have to say yeah right away. You could say, I mean, I know a way, but I'd love to learn from you. Do you want to show me how you do it? Because there's just so much knowledge within our people, so it's cool you could do that for your work.
I got a question for you, George. Where's your shrimp spot?
Ooh, I don't know, yeah.
You guys can't see the lip movement in here right now.
Pointing. In the water. That's what I try and tell them.
What brings you to this, to your work or any work?
Like I said, I spent my young childhood outside of Yakutat in Icy Bay. My dad was working a logging camp up there. And it was kind of one of those situations where, like, my dad was the only Indigenous person there. So I kind of accidentally lived the culture because, like, my dad wasn't super connected to it at the time. I just spent all my youth hunting and fishing and mucking around on the beach and living on the coast. That's, you know, a huge part of the culture, but I didn't get any of the looking part, you know. But then we moved back to Kasan, which is where the family's from. And, you know, I spent my teenage years there and worked with Stan Marsden on a totem pole that he was doing there at the school. It was the first pole that they'd raised in Kasan in like 100 years or something like that. And there was kind of this thing that like happened where I didn't identify with my culture very much. And then I identified with it really strongly. And then I didn't identify with it again. I think kind of chasing like some American ideal of, you know, what I was supposed to do in my 20s and like individual success and what that looks like, which isn't really the way. And then when I disassociated with it, yeah, I dropped the torch, you know, Like somebody passed the torch off, I wasn't there to pick it up. When I came to that realization, I was like, oh, where's the culture camps? Like, why isn't this happening? Why isn't that happening? And I was like, oh, that's because nobody's doing it. I'm not doing it. Nobody else is doing it, you know? And so I just decided to start doing it. And then tried to refocus on understanding really what it means to be Haida, like in the way that my great nan used to live and the way that her parents lived, used to live in this kind of idea of giving without receiving, really trusting in that even when it's kind of difficult, because that's the opposite of the American society. It's not about, it's about taking, right? So if you're giving, then now people want to take.
A true leader, a true person of power was someone that was willing to sacrifice almost all for his people or for their people. And then like when we're talking about honoring the generations before us and after us, like that's the most important part of all this. You know, that's why we're sitting here at these retreats. That's why we go to all these conferences, because guess who was doing it before us? The only reason I have the opportunity to sit here and have these conversations is because of the ancestors that were fighting for my rights before this. Understanding that and like trying to change that Americanized way of thinking of take and take and take. Could you imagine if you were trying to outgive me? I'm going to give better than you. What kind of world would we live in? And we would be here taking care of each other. Everybody would have food security. That was something that really stuck with me. It's like, just if you're not at the table, you're on the menu.
This is why our languages are really important, because they change how you perceive. It's really important because now a lot of us as Indigenous people are trying to either work with or against the federal government, the state government, you know, colonizer governments. And we use their language when we talk about those things. And it's really difficult to do that because we can't necessarily convey the mindset through English. At least for the Haida people, we didn't have chiefs, right? We didn't have leaders in that way. You had Itlak Das, which is, it means a rich man, is like the quickest way to translate it. But really what it means is someone who can't make decisions or doesn't make decisions. And it also means somebody who doesn't talk much or like doesn't say much. So when you're talking about somebody who has a lot of wealth, you're talking about someone who doesn't say a whole lot and doesn't make any decisions. They don't need to talk because the people do it for them, right? They don't need to make decisions. People respect what happens there. That's kind of the whole idea of wealth in the society, is that do good things, get good things. Keep feeding people and keep feeding people. If they do the same, then everybody's getting fed.
Yeah, the way we host each other really shows strength in out-hosting each other all the time. That's kind of what makes us sustainable, is that we're always hosting each other and always uplifting each other and knowing that this system will support our needs. I think that really is what has helped us to sustain this culture through colonization. The depth of our culture is the way we love each other, the way we respect each other, the way we uplift each other. It's these undercurrents, it's these philosophies, it's the respect and the reciprocity that go without saying. It's the lens that you see somebody for their clan and their family. When you look at somebody, you can see their grandparents whose house you grew up having cookies at, or they made you moccasins, or the uncle that helped teach you how to fillet your first fish is also their uncle, or, you know, all of these things that sustain our culture. It's not always visible, and it's not necessarily our responsibility to make it visible. It's just our responsibility to live it, to keep living it, and to have these cultural events. My niece used to always say she has this reoccurring nightmare. And her reoccurring nightmare is that she marries a guy and goes and lives inside of a city like LA or New York and is never able to access the real true earth. That she wakes up in concrete and lives in concrete and eats out of a store, and her diet is soda and, you know, processed chicken, and they never leave the walls of the city. And she's had this like weird reoccurring nightmare I'm like, you don't have to marry. I don't know.
Her reoccurring nightmare is called the American dream.
And it's so different than what we live, that it's a nightmare for some folks.
No, for sure.
What we're coming across is one of the first generations in thousands of years where we don't have fluent speaking elders and knowledge bearers of our protocol. It's people our age who know how to do a lot of those things and are putting on the culture camps and stewarding a lot of this cultural style living and infusing it within the organizations, you know, and really investing deeper into our tribes. When I came back to Yakutat, there wasn't culture camps either. And I was like, we're probably going to do that. So we started doing that. And I think that's really just our way. It's like noticing the needs of our community and being contributors, hosting other people, finding ways to be a part of it, not waiting to be asked. You know, it's kind of like you walk into the kitchen and if you're asking what to do, you're already not doing anything. You already know there's stuff to do. Just wash a dish, yeah. You know?
I was always told it's better to be asked to get out of the way. Than to get in the way.
Right.
I always like saying, like, you can't have the word community without unity in it, right? So, like, whenever we're hosting, like, these events and these cultural aspects and stuff, it's bringing all the aunties together, and they're in the kitchen, and they're laughing, and they're, you know, making things happen in there. And then the uncles are out harvesting and taking the littles out and getting slimy and bloody and stuff. That's what it's about, and you can see light bulbs going off.
It's huge, yeah. It's like you got to get away from the idea of these culture camps as being, like, classes. It's not classes. It's a space for people to be indigenous without having to feel reserved about it, you know? Like, because it doesn't always feel safe to be indigenous.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? When you get into those situations in those spaces and everybody's just hanging out and we got multiple generations in a big house and we're cooking and eating, that's just how our ancestors lived their life, was if there was something that needed help, somebody did it. If somebody was hungry, somebody else got them food. People were doing what they were good at and working together and spending that time.
They were intergenerational households.
Yeah. And that's what we have for a week.
That's a big deal for a lot of people. It's mind blowing. Yeah.
When we're talking about like the Americanizing things, it's like that was the most important part about breaking the family up.
Yeah. Oof. Yeah. And that's what we're creating at these culture camps, is that intergenerational opportunity. We have to like seek it out and be intentional about how we're sharing, because it comes so easy once you're there, everybody shows up, we're just like, hey, I don't like how you filleted that fish. I'm going to show you how to do it next time. And they do the next 40 or whatever, you know? Yeah, That worked out really well. Everybody's laughing.
It's a good time. I think I remember reading in some old book, might have been like Gilbert said or something like that. Gilbert McLeod, he was from Craig, and he was an elder over there, and he was talking about how that his uncles just talked mad crap because you have to pay attention to find out when they're being serious. So you're always paying attention because you never know. You never know when there's going to be a nugget of wisdom. You got to be listening.
You're ready to catch it.
And talking mad crap the whole time. And you're like.
And then the knowledge bomb.
All right. So then I would do that. Like when I was in Washington, I was like, I'm talking crap all the time. And people was like, man, that guy's a real jerk. Yeah. And I was like, you guys aren't listening. You're not paying attention.
Sometimes I get to the point where I look at somebody and I'm like, hey, the only reason I'm acting like this is because I think I like you.
Right.
You know,
it's like, that like investment of time and energy.
Yeah, exactly. And like
silliness,
I'm sit
and
here
sarcasm and laughter.
Laughter is the best medicine.
When I was younger, there was only 40 people in Kasan, and there wasn't a whole lot of elders there at that point. There was just one or two. Some of those elders are the same elders that we have now. We got this big gap all of a sudden. Like, for instance, right, as a 16-year-old, I hadn't had seal or the oil or didn't know anybody that did it, didn't know how to do it myself. My dad didn't know how to do it. So you're kind of starting at ground zero, trying to, like, reinvent the wheel or reinvent the seal, if you will.
Ooh,
yeah. That's for my kids. I wasn't used to eating seal. I didn't know what it was supposed to taste like, and so I made it taste a way that I could eat it without being used to eating it that way. Yeah, so I cold press my seal oil. I run it through a meat grinder, like a fine meat grinder, and then I strain it. The cold press stuff is like almost floral. Like, it's super subtle. It's really fine.
It's like a sweet, salty cucumber almost flavor.
Wow.
It's the sole property of the Kasan Haida.
Oh, yeah.
George's brother did the... some, like, was it habanero infused seal oil?
Some habanero seal oil.
Some infusions. That's good.
He made some other, like, fermented hot sauce that he used seal oil in.
So, like, now we're doing that with a lot of the kids, right? They were, like, you know, we had a summer lunch program, and, like, they were serving those kids abalone down there. And a lot of those kids were like, gross, yuck, this stink. Weird. Because nobody had had it. They didn't know it was like, nobody had been eating it. So when they were introduced to that, they're like, where's the fish sticks? You know, and it's like, they're not here. That's part of the reason that I kind of like doing like the cold press stuff too, or infusing, like bringing some of that modern stuff to it, is because there's a lot of people that have recoiled at like seal, like, ugh, I can't do that. But then I'll like make some chili and they're like, no, that was great chili.
What was that, protein?
Yeah. Was that chili? That was seal, bro. That was seal. That was the seal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that's what it is.
See
good stuff.
Boots? That's also the same also animal. The seal.
Also the seal.
Yeah, I think that brings up something for me that is also shifting, is when kids make comments like that. When I was a kid, you can internally know that you don't like it, but you got to find some way to be like, oh, thanks, Auntie. Take
That's
it
part of
move.
The respect.
Yeah, it's the respect. Of it, right? You cannot disrespect these animals. You cannot disrespect someone else's cooking. You cannot disrespect anything because they're hosting you.
At this last culture camp, before we did anything with the animals, we got the group of kids together and we made it very clear that we were going to be as respectful as we possibly can, because these animals sacrificed themselves for us. They presented themselves for us in order to have this opportunity to show you how to do it. So like wrinkled noses and stank faces and all that stuff, like, of course it's going to happen, but like being able to adjust it then and there in that situation and that opportunity to like not shame them, but bring enlightenment to the idea of you're being disrespectful. It's really important to understand that we have to put respectful energy into what we're doing.
Words are power.
Yeah, I think that's a lot of the slow cadence that you're talking about, and the taking turns of indigenous cultures too, is that words have power component, and really letting people have their time, that moment, and also just letting the energy just kind of sit and be, and just kind of feel the maybe new ideas that were brought up, and not forcing an answer right away, not forcing a solution. They used to talk about in Yakutat how city council meetings, when it was all indigenous people, they were the slowest meetings of all time. They would just take hours because there would be like something brought up and they'd be like, what is the wish of the board? And everybody just sit there for like 10 minutes, like, thinking about all the history of all
mind,
time.
Yeah, well, mind.
The implications of this for my great, great, great grandchildren. No one's speaking or talking, you know, and then finally the most respected person who's allowed to speak first, you know, and people know who can kind of break that ice, says something, and it just kind of has these unspoken rules within the culture that you know who can kind of speak in that way. I love that about our culture. I mean, this is what I want our kids to have. Mm-hmm. This is why we do the things. That's why Tlingit and Haida and all these organizations, it's like we're a race against the clock. But at the same time, the solution is just to be indigenous.
We say it in the village, full-time Haidas doing Haida things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
That's the best
we're
way.
Actively living our culture.
I think we were talking about that the other day with Forrester Island. Forrester Island, for those of you who don't know, is about 20 miles off the coast of Prince of Wales out in the ocean. And there's nothing between it and Prince of Wales. But people used to go out there. It was shared territory between the west coast and the east coast of Prince of Wales for bird eggs. All the birds go out there and lay their eggs out there. Well, it's such a trek, 20 miles of open ocean. And the island was considered so powerful that when people would go over there, it has a name, but nobody would say the name. They would always call it something else, like Chinaw or Big Rock or something. They wouldn't talk about it specifically. And the whole time as they went out there, they'd be talking and putting power into words like, we're not getting eggs. We're just lost out here trying to catch some fish. You know, like saying stuff like that. You know, put into power those words to throw off whatever kind of supernatural power.
The energy that exists. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they want to say, we're going to get bird eggs from Forrester Island. Right. Nobody would ever say that.
Right. There'd be no birds.
There'd be no birds. Uh-huh. They'd leave. Yeah. They know. Oh, like we told them.
They're coming.
Yeah. I was just thinking about how that's like spilled into modern culture, where like we'll go out fishing. It's like, I didn't want to catch anything anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I didn't want that one. It's too small.
I'm only hiking in the woods today with a rifle.
That's a derivative. of what people were doing in the past. And now it's just kind of funny, but it's rooted in a really serious purpose.
I think it's just being humble and like not assuming that when you go out there, it's going to be there for you. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like this assumption that you can just take.
Yeah, all those other things that present themselves along the journey, those are offerings. For me personally, I always bring something with me to replace what I'm taking, especially like in a successful harvest. How Solana, thank you for this opportunity. And then I give it a drink of water, or I leave a token of some sort, because that's a really important for me personally to like show my respects, because that's a big deal.
They live there too. I mean, it's always this knowing we're going into the woods. This is a place where moose and bears live. We're going into their backyard. We're going into their home, and just having that humility and that humbleness.
We're a guest.
Whenever I'm out there like surfing in Yakutat and there's a sea lion, I'm like, oh, buddy. I know you're the boss. And I appreciate your energy. I'm going to go ahead and go into shore, and you have a great day.
Something I like to think of was something that Woody Morrison said. He was from Heidelberg, but he lived in Vancouver. It was Die Haslat de Ukiagungung. And basically what it translates to is kind of like great spirit. My spirit calls out, come see what I need. It's kind of like a prayer phrase, I guess, as close as you can get to that in Haida. But basically the idea is that you as a person cannot know what is good for you, because there's bigger forces out there. And so when you're in trouble and you're having a hard time, you don't ask for what you want. So you just have to kind of give into that and be like, my spirit's calling out, give me what I need at this moment. Because the universe or Solana or whatever knows what's best for you. And you have to be okay with that. I say it to myself quite a bit when I'm having hard moments. I wanted to bring that up because we were talking about being humble and we were talking about it, but you know, we're still using English, and English isn't the right language to convey kind of what we're talking about. So I just wanted to say that in a language that was built for it.
Words with direction.
Well, thanks for having this conversation, guys. I enjoyed kind of learning a little bit about you guys, and thanks for offering this opportunity for us.
Yeah, thank you for the space.
Yeah.
Cheers.
How are?
Alaska Voices is a place for communities to connect through conversation. This podcast was the brainchild of Jesse Young Robertson and Bob Bolton, with support from the Alaska Climate Adaptation Science Center, who also funded today's episode. The Alaska CASC is committed to providing regionally relevant science for Alaska's changing climate. Alaska Voices would not be possible without the efforts of an amazing group of people. Our producer and audio engineer is Kelsey Skonberg of Mossy Stone Media. The Alaska Voices team includes Micah Hahn at the University of Alaska Anchorage, and Leah Ferguson, Mike DeLu, Annika Ord, and Diego Nareña at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. If you are interested in more conversations or information, please visit our website at alaskavoices.org.